Okay. So please sit down comfortably. And when you're sitting comfortably, then we will begin. Okay. Here comes the first question for tonight. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahm, this morning you spoke of Satipatthana, Satipatthana. Please give the correct spelling and meaning. Also, please elaborate what they are. Okay. The spelling is S for Samadhi, A for Anapanasati, T for cup of tea, I for inspiration, P for... Sorry?
Panya,
okay. A for Awija. That was ignorance. And it's got double T-H-A-N-A. That's how it's spelled, for those of you who want to know how to spell it. What it means is like the four, I call it the four focuses of mindfulness. And it's the mindfulness, first of all, on your body. Then, on number two, on these feelings of pleasure and pain, or in between, which is associated with every one of these six senses. Not to be confused with like the feeling of like emotion. This is pleasure, pain, or in between with every one of the six senses. So we use the word especially referring to the bodily sense of touch, pleasure and pain. But if we use sight, we don't call it pleasure and pain. We call it beauty and ugliness. If we call it sound, it's not pleasure and pain. It's like sonorous or grating sounds. We have all these different words for pleasure and pain. Smell, we've got sort of fragrant smell or stinky smell. And we've got taste. We've got delicious and yucky. It's like the suffering with regard to taste. And pleasure and pain is concerned with the body. And with the mind, we've got like joy and maybe depression, disappointment, the suffering inside. So with every one of these senses, there's a different word for the pleasure and pain. But in Pali, they've just got one word which covers all of the pleasurable senses, sensations in the six senses. It's called sukha. And they've got one word which carries all the unpleasantness of the six senses called dukkha. And this is what feeling is. The degree of happiness or unhappiness concerned with sensory experience. And that's the second of the foundations of the focuses of mindfulness. Your pleasure and pain. Your happiness or suffering. Number three is the citta, the mind, the consciousness, that which knows. And number four is the dhammas. Sometimes those include the mental formations, including will. In other words, that this comprises the five khandhas of existence. The body, the feeling, the perception, the mental formations such as will, the doer, and consciousness itself. And the reason we have these four satipatthanas is by watching each one of them. You look at this body and you see, this cannot be me. It cannot be mine. It doesn't belong to me. It's not a self. So it's a waste of time calling yourself Sri Lankan or Malaysian or English or Australian. That's not who you are. You're not a male. You're not a female. You're none of those. So really, if you understood this, you should be very confused with going into the toilets. That's why we have a sign out there, please do not use those toilets. People thought it was just so they don't make any noise, but no, it's because when you get enlightened, you're not quite sure which one you should use. So it's much better to use the ones in your dormitories, then it's no confusion at all. The point is, you're not any of those things. How can you identify with being a woman or being a man? You're confused, and what toilet should I use today? So you have the ones in the dormitories, which are unisex toilets in the dormitories. Now, and you're not, the next one not the body, not the feelings. The pleasure and pain, you can't control it. But if you identify, you say, I am hurting. I am aching. I am blissed out. And that's where you make the big mistake. Attaching and identifying to the happiness and suffering of life. Not realizing they're just like the weather, the night and the day. They just flow through the mind, irrespective of whether one wants to be happy or wants to be sad. There's this beautiful picture, photograph of Ajahn Chah. He was in England, and he was talking about this statue in the south of Thailand, of this monk with his arms up, in absolute bliss, with a caption underneath. Joy at last, to know there's no happiness in the world. Ah, it's a great saying that. When you know there's no happiness, in other words, you're completely out of control. It means you can't own happiness. Ah, joy at last. You stop striving for happiness. You stop complaining about unhappiness. Joy at last, to know you can't do anything about it. You can let go, and at last you're at peace. The striving and the struggling of life. Trying to escape from the pain and unhappiness and unpleasantness of life. Trying only to find the pleasure and the beauty and the joy you find is a useless struggle. So what do? You give up. You let go. And there you have all the bliss you want. Joy at last to know there's no jhana in life. So you give up jhana. You give up wanting jhana. You can't get it. Joy at last. So it's like jhana at last. To know that I can't get jhana. This is what happens. You get happiness once you give up the striving. As soon as you give up trying to control these things, happiness, peace, jhana, enlightenment comes to you. So it's figuring out all this pleasure and pain business, what it really is. And then we have the next kanda is like perception, mental formations and consciousness. Especially perception and consciousness. That's really is to do with the knower. What you're experiencing. And the mental formations. The main one is called will. And as one of my disciples from Singapore told me, because they read the Satipatthana Sutta in Chinese, and the Chinese character for the Sankhara is the same as the Chinese character for will. They got it right. That's the main aspect of that. In other words, my famous doer. You look at all these things. What is the doer? You look, what is the knower? That's the Satipatthana. So this is actually what we mean by the Satipatthana. Understanding what makes up the body and the mind. When you understand what makes up the body and the mind, you see this body is not me. The Vedana, the feelings aren't me. The will isn't me. And the knower isn't me. So will the real you please stand up? There's nothing left to stand up. It's all gone. So that's what we do Satipatthana for. But I will mention that in more detail in a talk coming soon on deep insight. Any questions on that? No? Okay, D, next question. Please clarify how advancing in meditation practice is connected to devotion or faith. Very good, yeah. Okay, because what happens as you get deeper in your meditation? All these teachings which you hear about suddenly make sense. You understand what letting go is. Because you do it, and it works, and you get bliss, and you get happiness. You understand why all these people teach like this. You understand just now why that sort of Buddhism is just so otherworldly, and why we sort of say, oh, you don't need very much to be happy. And you sort of come in here, giving up your home, you're giving up this, giving up everything. And you find out when you have a few things to worry about, you have just all this happiness and all this peace. So by like practicing meditation, you're actually testing out the teachings, experiencing them. And especially for people from Sri Lanka, because I was in Sri Lanka recently, for the last century or so, they believed that things like jhana are completely impossible in this day and age. And you can't become enlightened anymore. The boat's left, there's no more passengers. But the point is that when you do these meditations, if you don't get jhana yourself, you get that close, you realize, my goodness, it is possible. And you get some understanding through those jhanas of what enlightenment is, and you understand it is possible. And that really starts to increase your faith. When you walk along this path, you find out it works, my goodness. And also when we get to deep insight. For those of you who have got powerful minds already, We're going to teach you how to remember your past lives, to see who you were before. And isn't that fascinating? Because sometimes people think, oh, this past life business. Even some scholars have written about this. They say, oh, that wasn't part of original Buddhism. That was just the cultural additions to Buddhism. That's just Indian stuff. It doesn't have anything to do with the West. But that is not true. And through this meditation, you can learn about what past lives are and how they are, and even check out your own ones. And you start doing things like that, then of course your faith really gets very strong. It's not a question anymore, it's a knowledge that, yeah, you have lived before. And this mind, it doesn't just stop after the body stops. Nor does it just have one life afterwards. It goes on and on and on. And that gives you like faith that these guys, these monks, or people like the Buddha who taught like this, they weren't just teaching from theory. It wasn't just some cultural assumption. There's an underlying truth here. And you find it out for yourself. Which is why meditation does increase your faith. That what you read in those books, you practice in your meditation. And you find it works. You walk in the footsteps of the Buddha. You stand where the Buddha stood. And that really brings you faith. Inspiration. Joy. You can be like a Buddha. Somebody asked this question in this conference which we had. And they said, can girls become Buddha? Can we have girl Buddhas? A great question. And they had this monk from... A Sri Lankan monk from New York, who really stuffed up, made a big mess of the answer. Made everybody angry. Which is good, because when you get a conference, when people get angry, it gets really a bit of jostling, and people really get awake. And if everyone agrees, and it gets very easy, then tell people what they want to believe, then sometimes people go to sleep. So it's really one of the high points. Because everyone woke up, and they go, really? Oh, you can't say that. But can a girl be a Buddha? And the answer is, what is a Buddha? One of the beautiful sayings of the Buddha, it's in the Acuddhatipadopama Sutta, that if you can attain the first jhana, if you're experiencing that first jhana, you are standing in the footprints of the Buddha. What we would say these days, you are standing in the shoes of a Buddha. Your mind at that stage is no different than the mind of a Buddha in that first jhana. There's no difference there at all. And I mentioned that during this seminar. And I answered, girls can do that, men can do that, lay people, monks, nuns, anyone can do that. Old, young, Asian, Caucasian, we're all Asians. It doesn't really matter. So the point is, yes, in that sense, in an essential sense, in a real sense, anyone can be a Buddha. Right now, in this retreat, you can understand what a Buddha truly is by experiencing those deep states of mind. Right now. So that's the answer. Which people, yeah, let's go for it. So, that's actually how you can get faith. When you do things like that, wow, it's an experience. And you get huge amounts of faith in what's going on. Yes! Yeah, go.
With regard to the past life, although it's fascinating, how is it conducive to practice? Because I understand the Buddha only taught that which is conducive to practice.
Oh, it's great for practice. Number one, it sort of gives you this big picture of who you are and what's going on. What it shows you is you don't have to rush. Because sometimes you think, oh my goodness, how old am I now? If I don't get myself together quick, I'll have to do lots and lots of retreats. Practice really hard. But you always got another life afterwards. Many, many more retreats. If you don't make it this time, you make it next time. Take it easy, cool out. Don't get too stressed out trying to get to Nirvana. You know what people do? They get really scared. Ah, how old am I now? 40, 50, 60? My life expectancy is going and Alzheimer's is coming. Have you started forgetting things already? That's the first sign. Not knowing what day it is. So you get really scared of these sorts of things. That's actually what happens, you know, that I remember I was in the first year over here. There's one fellow had an epileptic fit in our... We had a little centre in North Perth, just, about half a... maybe a kilometre north of here. Had an epileptic fit, so he had to call the ambulance. And I didn't really know, you know, what to do in these situations. Had no experience about 20 years ago. And his ambulance, I was just watching them, see what they did. And the first thing they said, you know, to him was, what day was it? I found out afterwards, if you don't get the right answer, they think, you know, you're crazy, you're going to take you off. So be careful not to have an epileptic fit, because if they ask you what day it is, you probably won't be able to know, any of you. You just say it's now day, just like I say, then you go straight off to the funny farm. So be careful. But anyhow, so what it does is you remember your past lives. First of all, the fact you can do it is an inspiration, just knowing the power of the mind. And number two, it gives you a very fascinating understanding of what memory is, what real memory is. Because the memories of past lives and the memories of what you did yesterday are completely different. Now, one is a reliving of the occasion. And it puts this whole life in a perspective. First of all, it makes the ethical dilemmas of life very, very clear. I mean, for example, in the newspapers, if you were reading those newspapers before you came in here, there's this big ethical dilemma in the United States about this lady who was in a vegetative state, and the husband wanted to take out the tubes, and the Christian right lobby in the US wanted to keep them in. And they're saying, now, what are you doing? Are you sort of killing the person? I said, no, you're just hastening rebirth. Not hastening death. Hastening death, it sounds terrible. You're just hastening rebirth. Isn't that a good idea? What do you think? If you've got an old car and it's about to fall apart, wouldn't you want to sort of quickly get a new one? If you call it hastening death, well, maybe that's a bit sort of dodgy. But if you say it's hastening rebirth, having a quicker rebirth, is that wrong? If so, why? So a lot of these ethical dilemmas get to a completely different sort of realm when you have the idea of rebirth. And if like kids die when they're young, they get another chance afterwards. It's not such a sort of a terrible thing. But sort of in a one life idea that if a child dies, that's a tragedy. They haven't had a chance. But if, they've had many, many lives, yeah, maybe a bit sad, but they've got another go afterwards. Doesn't matter that much. Have another chance. So the whole thing becomes much more free and easy. The ethics become much more strong and compassionate and liberal and free. So it has huge consequences if once people actually remember past lives. And one of the reasons I've been really pushing this in meditation is that there's too many people are skeptical about it. And they say, where's the proof? Where's the evidence? So the evidence is there. Where is it? I say, okay, come on my retreat and I'll show you. So it's just that almost a bit of frustration that people don't believe too easily. And I want to make that proof that people, many people remember their past lives. So they have no doubts anymore. That's the truth. One of the consequences I keep on saying is that if we remember that people get reborn again, we will take much better care of our elderly people. The reason our society does not care for the elderly is simply because they think they've got nothing to contribute to society. They're useless baggage. They're pouring resources into the care and the nurture of the elderly is a waste. What economic benefit do you get out of it? What I say is those elderly people are going to come back again. So if you put resources in looking after the elderly, then when they get reborn again, you have these amazing children who are not so aggressive, angry, and rebellious. I always say the problem with the youth is the reincarnated old people getting their revenge. That's what I say. They'd be really badly treated by their children, so they get reborn again as children themselves, and they can really sort you guys out. So we should look after our elderly people, and then our children, when they get elderly people get reborn, they'll be more selfless, more kind. So there's little things like that. So if you can accept rebirth, it has huge consequences into many of the ways we look at life. That's why I want to encourage it. It does actually change your ethical framework and your spiritual framework too. Number one, you're not afraid of death. So don't you want to find out who you were before? Go back to your roots. De Ajahn Brahm. One, should walking meditation be done barefooted? If so, why? Any other way? Should walking meditation be done barefooted? Yeah, you could do that, barefooted. If so, why? Answer, why not? Any other way? Yeah, wear shoes. It's easy, isn't it? You can always try the middle way as well. We've put a shoe on one foot and the other one prepared. That's a middle way, isn't it? Half a half. The point is, it doesn't really matter so much, but I prefer doing barefoot because you actually feel the grass, or you can feel sort of the carpet. You can feel it on your feet. You become much more sensitive when you take your shoes off. And it can be done in socks, too, as long as your socks don't smell. Ajahn Brahm, do you consider it okay to play make-believe games with children and friends, or is it wrong speech? Thank you, from the JD. The Jedi, sorry. Is it okay to play make-believe games with children and friends, or is it wrong speech? No, it's okay, it's time and place, it's okay. Make-believe games. It depends upon time and place, what you're really doing, and who you are, and what is your role in life. If you're a father, and you're playing a make-believe game with your child or whatever, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that at all. But if you're making make-believe games with each other during this retreat, after everyone goes back, there's something wrong with that. So what make-believe games is? It's just a bit of fantasy, a bit of entertainment. Nothing wrong with that. I don't know if that was the right answer to the right... Did I understand the question okay? If not, please tell me tomorrow. Ajahn mentioned about not doing anything, but being aware as doing something will reduce mindfulness. How about chanting or bowing? What are those which we can do and those which we should not do? Okay, when you're meditating, don't do any chanting. And when you're meditating, don't do any bowing. Now, some people I've seen, they do bowing when they're meditating, almost bowing. Well, they're not really bowing. I'm just taking this bowing 100 times to the Buddha. So when you're chanting, we do the chanting. This is a doing. But what I'm saying about not doing is when you're meditating. In particular, there's that famous saying, when there's nothing to do, then do nothing. When there's something to do, for example, when it's your chores, you don't go along and say, Ajahn Brahm said I should do nothing. Ajahn Brahm said I should do nothing. So I refuse to do the chores. Then I'll get in big trouble and so will you. That's not an excuse that you're not to do your chores, to doing nothing. The point is, when there's something to do, give it everything you've got. So when you're chanting, put energy into it, fun into it, like I do when I chant. And you get more energy, you get more happiness, and it's better for your meditation. But when it's time to meditate, you stop everything. You do absolutely nothing. So that's what I mean by doing nothing. When it's meditation time, absolutely nothing. See how much nothing you can do. And how much peace, how you just really relax. Allow all this doing to sink away. There's no doing possible anymore. You just sink into the deep meditations. When it's something to do, give it effort. So when it's your duties here, do it effort. Do it as clean as you possibly can. You wash the dishes so they're sparkling. Put full effort into it. When there's nothing to do, do nothing. Okay. Did I answer that question? Is that quite clear? Okay, here comes the next question. Ajahn Brahm. The path you have laid out is wonderfully clear. Thank you. But If it was that wonderfully clear, there wouldn't be any other part to the question. But how far along it, in your experience and knowledge, have lay people travelled? What lifestyle conditions would have to be in place for it all to come together for lay people? In the time of the Buddha, lay people became enlightened. No difference in those times to these times. If they could do it, why can't you? So it's just a part. It doesn't really matter if you're a lay person or a man or a woman, whatever. The point is that wherever you have this practice, this is a great saying of the Buddha, wherever you find the Eightfold Path practice, doesn't matter what religion, what path, what race, what time, what era, lay men, lay women, monks or nuns, wherever the Eightfold Path is practiced, this is what happens. You get enlightened people. You put the causes into place, you get the results. So if you keep practicing this Eightfold Path, especially the meditation, Samma, Samadhi, Jhanas, this is what will happen to you, whether you like it or not. But be careful, because if you go that far and you become enlightened, there's certain things you can't do anymore. If you become even like a streamer or a once returner, you don't want to go down the pub anymore. So you lose all your drinking friends. Be prepared. If you become an anagami, you won't be interested in the cricket anymore. So be prepared, or in the movies. Not even in sex anymore. So sometimes people before a retreat, they think, oh well, this might be the time to get an anagami. So they just one last time. No. You don't know what's going to happen next. So leave it all alone. So this is just what happens if you get to these stages. But I will talk about the four stages of enlightenment later on. It is possible for you. But do you really want to? Do you want to disappear? Some people say, no, I don't want to disappear. My favorite quote on this is a disciple here in Perth. They're not here on this retreat. They were in this monastery in Sri Lanka. And he thought he was getting all these stages of enlightenment. And he rang up his wife and said, I'm a stream winner. I've just been told by the teacher. And his wife was so happy. Congratulations. A couple of days later he rang up. I've just been told I've got now to be a once returner. Amazing. Tremendous. And then he rang up again and said, I'm now a non-returner, according to my teacher. She said, hang on. Don't go any further. Come home, work, and pay off the mortgage before you go further. That's far enough, thank you. I want you back. If you become enlightened, don't care about working anymore, you won't pay off the mortgage. So she would have lost her provider. Anyway, that's what happens. I'll talk about that later on. Any questions about that so far? Okay,
that's a true story.
Yeah. He wasn't sort of an anagami, it was just the teacher was a bit overestimating everybody. Well, I was very happy about that afterwards. Dear Ajahn, I do not have heart attacks, but once a while when I walk or sit meditation, I do feel pain on my chest. So if I can't watch my breathing, what should I do? And where does the pain come from? Thank you. Yeah, it's probably just a bit of fear. Because sometimes when we think it's a heart attack, we have a little bit of pain. Think, uh-oh, this is a heart attack. And because of fear, it gets worse. Ah, this is a heart attack. You make a heart attack out of fear. It's amazing what fear would do. Fear can actually kill you. That story which I've told about the power of the mind, about this guy who was condemned to death by hanging in Bristol jail about 1901. Around about that, give or take 1 or 2 years, over 100 years ago. The night before his execution, two scientists had this idea, this test they wanted to do. They got permission. So the governor went to the jail and said, sir, the law has been changed. You still have to die tomorrow, but not by hanging. You would have your throat cut. And he left him to think about that. It's really gross, but this is what happened. And the poor man thought about that all night. In the morning, the guards came for him, tied his hands firmly behind his neck, his back, put on a blindfold, and led him to the place of execution. There they performed the last rites for him, and having read out the sentence, one of the guards performed the final rite, drawing the knife across his throat, at which he fell to the floor and died. The point was, it was a blunt knife. It was the prison washrooms. When they drew the blunt knife across his throat, one of the scientists turned on a tap. The man felt the cold steel, which he expected all night. He heard the sound of liquid dripping out. He thought he had his throat cut. He believed it so much that he died there and then. True story in the scientific journals. Fascinating just how fear can kill you. So the point is, if you have that fear, you can't watch your breathing, what should you do? Just let go. Be in the moment. Don't try anything. Just really relax and enjoy. If it's a heart attack, welcome. Nice of you to come and visit me. Relax. Gonna die somewhere. Isn't it wonderful to die on a retreat? Have a heart attack here. Because I can give you an immediate funeral service. Save you a lot of money. And you can die in such a beautiful state of mind. You just be meditating so peacefully. Wow, that's really good karma. To die on a meditation retreat, that's the best possible place you can really die. Where do you want to die anyway? Die at home when all these crazy people are just crying over you. Oh, don't go, don't go. Or to die in a hospital, which is really lonely, and people try to pump you and get you going again. Or to die here. Then people would say, ah, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Give you encouragement. Gonna die someday anyway. Might as well get it over and done with. So the point is, like, just let go, relax, and be mindful. It's the first possible thing you can do. And sometimes, if it is the beginnings of a heart attack, you stop it by just not overreacting, not being afraid, not increasing sort of the blood pressure. Or the heartbeat by fear. Shh, relax. So you can't do anything wrong by just relaxing. So if you do have a little bit of chest pain, just let it be. Don't try and get rid of it. If you want to, you can make that the object of your attention, just being with that. But do letting go. In the moment, silence. Shh. Just open your heart to whatever you're feeling. Best thing you can possibly do. Apparently, in most traumas, confirm this, it's the fear which sometimes kills you. You go into shock. And one of fellow monks I grew up with, he told me once that his sister, who lived in New York, she came home late from work, so she needed to go do some washing. She went to the laundromat. Stupid thing to do because it was late at night. This rapist came in there and pulled out a gun and told her to basically undress. He's about to rape her. And, you know, she was there by herself late at night. And the only thing she could think of doing, you know, I don't know which was the wise thing or stupid, but what she did do, she just charged at him, pushed him over, and then made a run for it. He got up and shot her. And, think twice. And she staggered to a doorway while he was chasing after her, knocked on the doorway. Fortunately, and this was very lucky, someone opened that doorway and let her in. And they called an ambulance. And she'd been meditating. So she just really relaxed and let go. And when actually my fellow monk went to visit her, apparently she said the doctors were quite surprised she survived the trauma. And she all puts it down to a meditation, be able to really relax and let go, and just allow things to happen. Otherwise, the shock of losing that much blood and a couple of bullet wounds would have killed her. She survived. I don't know if the doctors agree with that, but that's what she said. Certainly does no harm to relax. So, that's what you should do. Yeah. Any questions about that? Okay. Because usually that people don't get heart attacks during a meditation retreat because you're just so stress-free. It's when you leave you get the heart attacks, not while you're here. And you have to go back to work. Ah! It's so stress-free. Ajahn, why have you not suggested walking meditation on the stairs? Because it'd be that you haven't tried it? Yeah, actually, I never tried walking meditation on the stairs. That's a new one. I have, and it is such fun. Not for everyone, of course, but you could maybe add it to the menu of fun stuff as an option. Okay, because I don't go upstairs. I'm on the lower floor. I'm not one of the higher beings. So all you are higher beings going up and down the stairs. You can do walking meditation up and down the stairs and see what happens. Yeah, it's an interesting one. Okay. Richard. There's above, I'm getting more joy and mindfulness from the walking meditation than I've ever had before. And I'm getting better at it. Yesterday I calculated I averaged 0.16 kilometres. How do you do that? Per hour. Sorry, 0.16 kilometres per hour. Today I hope to improve on that figure so I go even slower. Do you think they'll ever make it an Olympic sport? That'd be good, like the slowest meditation. We're often thinking of having like Olympic meditation sports. Because you could have like levitation to see who gets the highest. That'd be very good. Or who can sit still the longest without moving. That'd be very good. It'd be really boring for the spectators. Just an hour after hour. The same with walking meditation as well. See how slow you can go. But you get this old guy who dies on the walking path and they think he's won. Okay. If so, I'm going into training right now. Maybe the 100 metres long distance or the 1500 metres 3-day event, Footloose and Fancy Free. Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Okay, next question. This is not related to meditation, but I'll be very thankful if you can explain it. The Buddha's last meal was wild mushrooms with pork. He knew the food was contaminated, yet he consumed it and asked that the rest be buried so they will not be served. He also said the man who offered his food should not be blamed. Question, why did he eat this food? And two, what is the Buddha trying to teach here? Look at me today, let alone the Buddha. There I was. I told everybody, I'm trying to lose weight on this retreat. I'm overweight, and I try to lose weight. And then all these people were standing out there in front of the food tray, trying to stuff food in my bowl. I kept saying, no, just a little bit. They weren't listening at all. Even I said, no, I don't want that. They still put it in. So now you can probably understand what happened to the Buddha. He said, no. He said, no, you must. So I said, well, you've got no choice what you eat. So it's probably the same with the Buddha, even though he knew it was going to kill him. So someone offered it to him. And it was their kindness. And this is actually sometimes what you do as a monk. Even if you don't like it, even if it's going to cause you a stomach ache. Somebody's offered that to you. They've come all this way. They put so much care and love into cooking that for you. Can you refuse it? In the end, you say, no, it doesn't matter. I'll take the stomach ache. Because of, you've been so kind. This is what monks do. Because I can never mind, put it in my bowl. That's maybe some of the reason. Even though he knew he was going to kill him, you just say, oh, well, this the person was being kind, needed to do it. Imagine like giving food to a Buddha. It's amazing. And the reason it's like good karma for the man who gave it to him, because from that food, it stopped his life completely. He'd done all the jobs already, and that meant he could actually go parinibbana at last, finish with all this teaching business. He wouldn't need to give any more retreats, no more talks. I don't know what people are asking questions of him anymore. He could retire. So one of the terrible things about being a monk, one of the disadvantages of the monk life, that we can't retire. 60, and that's when you start getting into it. 70, that's when people really like to visit you. That's when you really become venerable. An 80-year-old monk, they don't leave you alone. So I know the older I get, the harder I have to work. You guys, 60 or 70, then you can actually relax. You can actually do nothing. People leave you alone, not monks. The older, the better. You see these old monks, and oh, they're poor things. People don't leave them alone. So, you can see this person relieve the Buddha of that burden. Parinibbana. All this life and death business, it's just like the Buddha left samsara. It's a wonderful thing. Last meal, says bye-bye, and gone. That makes sense? That's one answer anyway. Next question. Dear Ajahn, during my meditation today, I am in immense physical pain, having gone for the extra mile. I can't just let go, but having, through dumb investigation on the virtue of Kanti and Virya, the pain gradually subsided mentally, and I regained concentration. Is it the right way to practice? Please advise. Okay, you had immense physical pain because you want to go the extra mile. Where are you trying to get to? Going the extra mile. It's good that you've done that, so well done. I shouldn't make fun of you because it's a hard thing to do to endure pain. And you know, it's praiseworthy in that sense. You've got some endurance, so it's well done. But you don't have to do that. It's much better, actually, to develop that wisdom and be like a Buddha in the middle way. If you can't get rid of the physical pain, then you have to endure it. So some endurance is quite useful for you, because some pains you can't do anything about. But what usually happens with the physical pain, it just makes the mind very tense. The mind associates meditation with pain. It's called, as I said this morning, anapanasati. And it's not what the Buddha advised. He usually has more negative results than positive ones. Even though this one was a positive one, because you managed actually to see the pain gradually subside and regain concentration, it's not really recommended. If you get a little bit of pain, it's okay to enjoy a little bit of pain. If it gets immense and huge, move. Otherwise, you may get into these terrible states and you go and sue the Buddhist Society of West Australia because you can't walk again or whatever. But it's not really that. It's just out of kindness to you. So the pain in the body, that sometimes it is restlessness. But if it's immense pain, it's usually a sign that your posture is wrong or you've been sitting too long. Time to get up and move. And you don't lose anything by just very softly, very gradually, gently getting up and changing your posture. Even if it's just carrying on sitting, but just crossing one leg to another leg. Or just getting up and sitting in a chair, or doing walking and then coming back again. That is by far the best. To have ease of the body, so you can get ease of the mind. Any questions on that one? Next question. Can one change the course of karma? Is it possible for a human being to be reborn in the animal realm? What is the relationship between karmas and conditions? Thank you. Once you understand what the mind is, you understand what karma is and understand how it all works and how you can get reborn in the animal realm. If you want to be an animal, just like I said, that person who wanted to become reborn as a cat. I think many Western people do get reborn as dogs or cats because they think it's a good life. However, you ask a doctor, and they'll say, no. No, actually, they don't say no, they say bow wow. But that means no. So, it is possible for a human being to be reborn in the animal realm. The animals can get reborn in the human realm. It's not that big a difference. The karma and the condition, can you change the course of your karma? You're always changing the course of your karma. Every moment you're making new karma. And you can change it this way and that way. It's amazing just how much you can change your karma. The ability to change is quite huge, but people don't make use of that ability. Sometimes we get stuck in our old conditioning. So we keep repeating the same things which made bad karma in the past. And because we get stuck in that, we just don't know how to get out. But with meditation, you actually stop all your conditionings. One of the great things with meditation, you actually free the mind from thinking in certain ways, from looking in certain ways. I mentioned this to one person doing research. If you get into a deep meditation, once the five hindrances have disappeared, when you emerge afterwards, those five hindrances are gone for a long time. So you can actually see things in a different way. You're not straitjacketed in your thinking. You can actually see things in a way no one else has seen. A lot of creativity comes after a deep meditation. And so, it's also new ways of dealing with situations. New habits can be a good habit. Positive karma can actually be started after deep meditation. You can actually change your habits, especially your bad ones. And that way that you do change the course of karma. You literally recondition yourself. Just like when your computer gets stuck. You reboot it. You turn it off so it goes to cessation and you turn it on again. That's right, isn't it? Called rebooting. It's just like jhanas. You turn it all off and kickstart it again. This is rebooted. I don't know anything about computers, but I hope that's right. Just making it up as I go along, as usual. Dear Ajahn Brahm, for meditation to be successful, if the doer has to get out of the way all the time, what is the rationale for a doer to exist? Yeah, marvellous. There's no rationale at all except to create suffering. So, get rid of the doer. And then you'll too be an arahant. You see, the whole purpose of a doer is just to defeat its object. It's just, you know, just to create problems for you. That's why the Buddha said, house builder, you have been seen, you will never build any more suffering for me. It's one of the sayings. House builder, the doer, craving. And after a while you think, what's the point of this? And you're right, there's no point. So you stop. And when you stop, the world stops. When the world stops, you're enlightened. No more birth. Is that quite clear? But I'll mention that when we talk about enlightenment and deep insight in a few days or time, hours' time. Who knows? Oh, who said what in the 1970s Star Trek? You got a Trekkie here. It's life, Jim. That's right, Dr. Bones McCoy. That's right, I remember Dr. Bones McCoy. It's life, Jim, etc., but not as we know it. We come in peace, shoot to kill. Captain James T. Kirk on landing in Iraq. My bonny engines cannot take much more, Ajahn. Chief Engineer Scotty, upon entering first jhana. My bonny engines cannot take much more, Ajahn. That's not true. You can take even more. There's no limit to the amount of bliss you can take. No limit to the amount of peace you can experience. Your engines can take even more bliss. There's no limit. So Engineer Scotty was wrong upon that one. Hey, Ajahn, how does the right thought relate to the non-thinking mind, which was said to lead us to the final liberation? Okay, right thought is like thought which is thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of non-cruelty. It's called right thought according to the Buddha. Nekama vitaka or nekama sankapa is the first one, the major one. Nekama is literally renouncing, giving up. And I mention that Pali word because it also occurs in Nekama Sukha, the happiness of renunciation. You know what that is? Jhana. It's another word for the experience of bliss in jhana, the bliss of renouncing. And this is the thoughts of renouncing. So it's like the thoughts which lead to jhanas. Renouncing thought. Letting it all go. That is right thought, according to the Buddha. Thoughts of loving kindness. The door of my hope and heart is open to whatever's happening. Letting go. Thoughts of non-cruelty. It means not saying, you stupid meditator, how many times have you been coming to this retreat and you still can't even get nimittas? All these other people, I bet they've all got nimittas now, but not me. I'm really stupid. I'm not going to have any cup of tea this evening. I'm going to sit up. I'm going to work through pain. I'm going to be so cruel to my body and cruel to myself. That's not the way. So thoughts of non-cruelty, of kindness and forgiveness. So little me, I slept all day. Every time I sat down for the last 4 or 5 days, I've been thinking these crazy sexual fantasies or planning this or thinking that. Never mind. That's all right. The door of my heart's open to that as well. Absolute non-cruelty, acceptance, letting go, being at peace with oneself. Can you do that? If you can, that's called right thought. So the right thought, the thoughts of letting go, renouncing. Thoughts of loving kindness, accepting. Thoughts of non-cruelty is called right thought by the Buddha in the Eightfold Path. So do you understand why that leads to jhanas, to nirvana? It's what I've been talking about all week. That is right thought. Next question. The simile of my son, the beautiful breath, Nimitta, who cares? The beautiful breath, Nimitta, who cares, and I have none. Oh, the beautiful breath, Nimitta, who cares, and I have none. I just go there to sit it out, watching the in and out my breaths as instructed by the teacher. Like my son who knows he has to go to school and tuition classes every day without any resistance and expectations. Is my approach to meditation in this retreat okay? Does your son go to school? Hope he does. Because sometimes that he may just go to school and then just hang out in the mall afterwards, play hooky. I hope he doesn't, but sometimes people do that. They go there and they go out immediately afterwards. But the point is here, it is just good to go sit on the cushion and let go. In school you have to do something, you have to do some work, because that's what you have to do to learn. But in meditation, the path is just sit there and do nothing. Stop controlling. Be peace. The right thought. Thoughts of renunciation, letting go. To understand that more deeply, some years ago I gave the simile of the balloon. The idea of meditation is like going high into the air where it's nice and peaceful, where you've got a beautiful view. So you get in one of these hot air balloons. And you go as high as you can, and then you got stuck there. You can't go any further, any higher. So you think, why can't I go higher? And you look for something in the balloon to chuck out your ballast, your attachments. So you find a couple of bags of sand, you throw them out. And then you go high, much higher. But you stop at a certain altitude. But you want to go higher. So you look for what else is in there. So you look for your sensory enjoyments, your lunch. You throw that out too. And your thermos full of tea or coffee. Throw it all out. And so the basket is completely empty. And it goes higher than ever before. But then you get stuck. You can't go any further. And you wonder, what can I throw out now? And look, the basket's empty. There's nothing more to throw out. But then you get the great insight. Throw the basket out. So you untie the basket, you hang on to the ropes, the basket leaves, and you go higher than you've ever been before as you've discarded, renounced the basket. And there you are holding to the ropes. But you can't go any higher. And you think, what else can I throw away? What else can I throw away? And you get the great insight. I'll throw me away. So you let go of the ropes, you throw you away, and the basket goes out to nirvana. In that simile, throwing out the sandbags is these ordinary possessions which you have, cars, family, houses, money, all that sort of stuff. And you go really high in your balloon. Then you've got to throw out your sensory pleasures, your food, your enjoyments of bodily happiness. And you go really high, and you get so high, in deep meditation, but what can I throw out now? The basket is your body. You are the basket case. So you throw out your body. You don't care about aches and pains or worrying about this body. You just sit there and the whole body disappears. When you throw out your body, you just go really high. But the last thing is you, the doer. You've got to throw you out. Throw the doer out. Because that little thing hanging onto the ropes, hanging on, attaching, doing things, it's my balloon. You have to let that one go. And then the balloon goes all the way into jhana. The path is, but not the one feet travelling on it. Nibbana is, but not the one who enters. That's why you have to let go. Okay? That's what renouncing is. Last question. Oh, good. Good timing today. Venerable Ajahn Brahm. Little heart next to it. That's very nice. Let go in love making, eh? This little heart is. Okay. Here we go. If anybody under 18 would like to leave at this gesture and go to bed, it's an adult question, maybe. Dear Venerable Ajahn Brahm, let go in love making is one of the few gateways that lay people have to express states of deep meditative bliss. I am talking about this in the context of loving committed relation as opposed to having sex, which implies it is on an animal level. Please comment. Sappy stick. Remember the symbol of the sappy stick? This sign, Mr. and Mrs. Sappy Stick. Okay, lovemaking. I'm really into lovemaking as a monk. It's really good. But I'm in love, the big zero. As in tennis, love. So make zero, make nothing. You know, like they have the word for zero in tennis is love. So see if you can actually do love making. Zero making in your meditation. So nothing is there. Not making one, not making two, three, four, five, six. That's what happens when you have sex. You start off with two, you end up three, four, five, six. But in meditation, you make less. Things start to disappear. There's too many people in this world already. The world is overpopulated. Singapore or Perth? So we need less. We need more monks and more nuns to solve the world population problem. So anyway, we serve lovemaking. So when you are meditating, you're not trying to get somewhere or make something. It's not making jhanas. It's not giving birth to bliss or not procreating nibbana. It's not getting new experiences. It's letting go of things. It is making nil, making zero, making love. So when people say, what are you doing when you do meditation with Ajahn Brahm? You say, I'm making love. They get, what? I'm making nothing. I say, ah. So make nothing out of this meditation. See how much can disappear. Okay? That's a curly question. I don't think I answered it the way you maybe wanted me to answer it. But it's getting late. And that's what you're getting. Making love, making nothing. That's what I do actually. Isn't that used to say when you sort of have romance? You whisper sweet nothings to each other. Whispering sweet nothings means like whispering jhana, whispering enlightenment. Aren't they sweet nothings? Because hey, we always want something in life. And very few people want to let go. We want to attain more, get more, accumulate more, have more. And that makes us a bigger self. But letting go means we go nearer and nearer to zero, to love. What is in the middle of the present moment? What is in the middle of now? This big O between the N and the W. Zero is in the middle of now. So that's what we go to. There's silence where there's no words. The peace of the beautiful breath where everybody in this room disappears. When your body disappears, there's not even me, let alone anybody else. There's no one here. And when you go to the jhanas, there's no one doing anything. And when all the jhanas disappear, and you go into emptiness, not even anybody watching anymore, everything has disappeared. And zero, love, making love. This is Ajahn Brahm's way of making love. Okay, there we go. Any comments or questions about that? Yeah?
I just want a question of the Buddha. You said Buddha is someone who rediscovered Buddhism after Buddhism
Yeah. Ah, who knows? If, actually, that the answer is actually, it says in one place in the suttas, only a male can become that Buddha. But you don't have to believe those suttas. Actually, part of being a Buddhist is actually being able to rebel against the written word, and the Buddha actually tells you, yes, do that. And the point is, if a woman became enlightened, when there was no Buddhism left, and started teaching, we'd have a female Buddha. There's no reason why not. Because there are... There's a fascinating point here. I get into trouble sometimes, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest that when, in the Buddha's last life, when he descended from the Tusita realm, that he was what we call like a once-returner. Because we all know, and it's part of the earliest description of the Buddha's life, that after his birth he could speak... And he said, this is my last life. And that someone could say that, only like a once returner can say that. What's called like a Sakadagama, the second stage of enlightenment. It's also said elsewhere that once returners, they usually get reborn in the Tusita realm, and it's from there they come back to this realm. That's what usually happens. So that fits within being a once returner. And also that we know that one of the Buddha's previous lives, if not the previous life of the Buddha, was as the monk Jyotipala with Kassapa the Buddha. And he actually was a monk with a Buddha in a previous life, a very recent previous life. If he's got all those spiritual qualities and he actually ordained under a Buddha, surely he would have got something under that. At least a stream winner, if not a once returner. So there's a lot of evidence to suggest, yeah, the Buddha, or rather Siddhartha Gautama, in his life, came as a once-returner. And I always say that because there's many once-returners, if they get reborn in a time when there's no Buddhism around, they have to become enlightened in that birth. And so they've got two choices. Either they teach and become the Buddha. If they don't teach, they'll be a Pacheka Buddha. And the once returners don't always come back as men, come back as women. If they come back as women, then the Pacheka Buddha is a female Pacheka Buddha or a female Buddha. I can't see why that wouldn't happen. So that's my theory anyway. No one's going to have an argument with me. Okay, so there we go for this evening. So, it's up to you. Become a female Buddha. The next Buddha. Make it a female. Decide you want to do that. You going to go for it? Too long, yeah. It's a waste of time. Best become an arahat instead. Okay, enough of that. So, now it's over, not past 9 o'clock. Had lots of nice questions there. Building up momentum. Having all these lovely answers. See if you can do this letting go. Making love with the moment. Fully having this wonderful relationship with now. Being at peace with it. Accepting it for what it is. And seeing everything turn into zero. Zeroing in onto the zero inside. Where there's nothing. Then you're fully at peace. Nothing to make you tremble. Nothing to attach to. Nothing left. Everything disappears. Wow. Okay, so I'm going to close my eyes. And I'm sure when I open up again, many of you will be gone. And say, yeah, you've all disappeared. But I think you're not disappearing into nothing. Disappearing into your bedrooms. But never mind. Okay, so see you later on, maybe tomorrow.